The White House that President Trump has constructed has a lot of chiefs.
If she had become president, the world would still be this complicated.
This will probably get me in a lot of trouble, but I do think there is a degree of admiration for a strong man. I'm sorry.
I've never seen anything like this. People just flat out lie.
Welcome to the Global Politico. I'm Susan Glasser, and each week I'll be taking you backstage in a world disrupted. Join us every Monday morning for new episodes. Rate and subscribe to us on iTunes or whatever your preferred podcast platform is. And do email me anytime at sglasser@politico.com.
Words do matter. I hope that we will say even more, that the world is really a dark place when the United States of America is not involved. It's a dark place when we don't stand up for those who just want to have the same basic values that we have.
That was Condoleezza Rice, the former Secretary of State, and our guest this week on the Global Politico. Rice has a new book out, Democracy: Stories from the Long Road to Freedom, and in it, she's pushing what can only be described as a foreign policy that's the exact opposite of President Donald Trump and the new Secretary of State Rice personally recommended to him. Rice set out to write the book in a very different time, but of course it's being received in the post-Trump world, when there are urgent questions not just about the fate of democracy around the world, but right here in America. Rice was always the soul of diplomatic discretion in public, even when she was George W. Bush's top foreign policy advisor amid the controversies of the post-9/11 era. But Trump has clearly put her in a different sort of a bind, and one that, to me, encapsulates really the foreign policy challenge of the rest of the Republican Party these days. Do you hit Trump publicly or influence him privately? Cheer his evolution or warn of his failings? We spent about an hour together the other day for this interview in the midst of the unfolding uproar over Trump's firing of FBI Director James Comey. And Rice had a lot to say about the American institutions constraining the president, why Vladimir Putin hacked the election, and even the backstory as to why she thought her golfing buddy, oilman Rex Tillerson, might make a good Secretary of State. So thank you for listening to the Global Politico. And I hope you enjoy our interview. Well, I'm Susan Glasser, and welcome back. This week's guest, of course, is the great Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of State. By the way, I am a good student. I've read the book, so I promise we're not just going to
appreciate that. Thank you.
And by the way, it is not only a very timely book to look at democracy, but you know, it really takes us on a tour around the world in a way that you don't see a lot of former high-ranking public officials looking at what happened to democracy in Colombia, democracy in Africa. And so, you know, it's a good read among many other things. But it is timely, and we would be remiss if we didn't start with actually the headline that just came out right before our conversation. My friend Carlos reviewed your book more or less positively in the Washington Post. The headline that they put on the piece, I think, tells you, you know, a little bit about this situation. You know, basically says Condoleezza Rice's book is a repudiation of Donald Trump's America First philosophy. I don't know if you view it that way, but certainly that is the context in which it's being read today.
Well, since I started the book more than 3 years ago, there was no America First policy to which to react or to repudiate. And indeed, I think of it as really helping Americans to understand the great sweep of America's involvement in democratic transitions, the promotion of democracy, trying to help us understand it from the context of our own democracy and the very long road that it took us to get to stable democracy. In fact, before I get to today's context, people have asked me, well, why did you want to write a book about democracy? And I think at some level, I've always wanted to write it because as a child, I grew up in Birmingham, Alabama, when black citizens did not experience full democracy. We couldn't go to a movie theater or to a restaurant, and indeed I have one event in mind, time in mind, that really sort of encapsulates it for me. I was being picked up from school by my Uncle Alto, my mother's brother, and I was probably 6 years old or so. It was election day, the day that George Wallace was about to be elected the governor of Alabama, and there were long lines of black people standing ready to vote, and I said to my uncle, I said, so Alto, if all of those people vote, then Wallace can't win, because I knew in my own six-year-old way that he wasn't good for black people. And my uncle said, well, no, he said, we're still a minority. He's going to win. And I said, so why do they bother? And he said something that I'll never forget. He said, because they know that one day that vote will matter. And I then have watched long lines of Afghans and Iraqis and Liberians waiting to vote, because they know that one day that vote will matter. And so this mysterious thing that we call democracy, where people place their aspirations and their fears in the hands of institutions, is really quite a remarkable story. And it's remarkable in America, and it's remarkable across the world.
So, okay, one thing that's a big takeaway, obviously, is that your faith is undiminished, even at a time when there are lots of people here in the United States and around the world, including in the West, for the first time, we're saying, and certainly my adult lifetime, we're questioning some basic questions about the what we assume to be the march of progress and the march of democracy. But look, Donald Trump, that's, you know, nobody right now, except for you, is thinking about, you know, your childhood in segregated America. It's an extraordinary journey, but is this a step backwards? Are you trying to tell us it's okay if Donald Trump is president because our democracy in the long run will be fine?
I'm trying to tell Americans that they were bequeathed the best institutions that anybody's ever been given, and that one of the characteristics of those institutions was that they'd had a constrained executive. The founding fathers were quite concerned about executive power. They didn't ever want the presidency to just be about whoever happens to occupy that office. They created Article I, the Congress, and my good friend David Kennedy, Pulitzer Prize-winning American historian, talks about the fact that most of the discussion of the government in the Constitution is actually about the legislature, and most of it about the executive is how to get rid of him, necessarily, if necessary. And so it was constrained, and it was constrained not just by the legislature, but by courts, which can rule on constitutionality, a free press, which they respected, governors, federalism, and then civil society. And so the American presidency has to be understood in the context of all of the scaffolding for democracy, because democracy is built for disruption. People are going to challenge the institutions. But the institutions I have absolute faith in, and whatever we're going through now, I have tremendous faith in that, and that they're going to hold.
I don't want to dwell too much on whatever it is we're going through, but I did see Charles Krauthammer on TV yesterday saying, okay, we're going through something at the FBI, and I have a candidate for you, Congress, and Mr. President. Condoleezza Rice would be the perfect new director of the FBI, in his view, because of your background in Russia at a time when this investigation of the president potentially and certainly his team is unfolding, and at a time when there's questions about the independence and integrity of our institutions.
Well,
are you prepared to serve if asked?
I appreciate that very much. Anything I can do from California, I'm prepared to do. I'm very happy, Professor. Look, well, we will get good people into these positions, but we do need to know what happened. Something very objectionable happened here. The Russians tried to interfere in our elections. Now, they have tried to interfere in our elections for a long time. It's just that with cyber, they have a more efficient way of doing it, and they have a broader way of doing it. I am furious that they tried to, but I've also thought that Vladimir Putin, who's kind of an eye-for-an-eye person, would have interfered because, in his view, we called his elections fraudulent in 2012, which they were. And now he's going to demonstrate that he can undermine our confidence in our elections. So I would have preferred to say, we know you did it, Russia. At a time of our choosing, we will punish that. But we have confidence in our institutions. We have confidence in our electoral system. And because I can just imagine that in the Kremlin there's a lot of kind of chuckling about how much they have challenged and caused a lack of confidence in our electoral system. Mm-hmm.
President Trump just yesterday hosted in the Oval Office a day after firing James Comey, Sergei Lavrov, who you know well, of
yes,
course, you and I have talked about him before, and the Russian ambassador to the United States. It was the first time he's been welcomed in the Oval Office of the United States since 2013. President Putin personally, according to my reporting, asked President Trump to receive him. President Obama had refused repeated requests in recent years because of the Russian takeover of Crimea, because of the various other actions in the last few years by Russia. Was that a mistake?
Well, Putin received Rex Tillerson.
Yeah.
And so I have no problem with President Trump receiving Sergei Lavrov.
Mm-hmm.
I hope the messages were pretty strong, that we are never going to accept the forcible incorporation of Crimea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Susan, you will know that for 45 years, we did not accept the forcible incorporation of the Baltic states. We couldn't do anything about it, but we didn't accept it. We didn't legitimize it. And then when conditions changed, the Baltic states were among our best friends and now members of NATO because they remembered that. And so you can send long-term messages, but I think because President Putin had received Secretary Tillerson, it was probably appropriate for President Trump to receive Sergei Lavrov.
You know, let's get back to the theme of democracy. You mentioned Secretary Tillerson. Just last week, he gave a speech, a very unusual speech for a Secretary of State to give to the employees of the State Department, in which he appeared to separate American values like freedom and democracy from American interests. He said, even though those values are constant, such as our support for human rights, there are times when overriding interests dictate that we should set such values aside, in effect declaring that it will stand for liberty only when the costs of doing so are sufficiently low. You recommended Secretary Tillerson to President Trump, which is interesting, and I want to get your backstory on that. Is that your view? Do you agree with that?
Well, I did recommend him, and I think he's doing a fine job as Secretary of State. I read the speech with a little bit greater nuance than the way I think it's been portrayed, because I remember very well when I went to Egypt and I gave that speech about democracy in 2005 in Cairo. And after I gave the speech, people were saying, well, then how can you meet with Mubarak? Well, because sometimes in the interest of in America's interest or for policy, you have to meet with people who don't share your values, who might even assault your values. But it is the United States of America isn't an NGO. And so, yes, we sometimes, for policy reasons, have to deal with people who don't share our values. I think we're always better in the long run to remember that we are safest, most secure, and most prosperous when our values and our interests are inextricably linked. We just need to remember the history here. We need to remember that we took a risk that a democratic Germany was never going to invade its neighbors again, and it didn't. We took a risk that a democratic Japan was going to be a peaceful part of Asia, and it is. And so remembering that in the long run, we are always better served by countries that share our values is extremely important, even if one day you're having to sit across from Muammar Gaddafi, as I had to do as Secretary of State.
Well, of course, he, as we all know, had a fascination
with you. Now, why did I bring that one up?
you brought it up. You know, you can go read those cables yourselves, but, you know, why did he have this fascination?
I really don't know. I just remember that.
He wrote the song,
yeah,
too,
I
right?
remember Black Flower in the White House. It was one of the weirder moments as Secretary of State. That's when you think, okay, time to get out of here and go to Algeria.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Remember, it was Donald Trump who rented him the tent, you know, for $200,000.
Well, somebody had to rent him a tent, I guess.
Okay. You've just made actually a super important point, though, about this Tillerson speech and what does it mean and how should we interpret it. I think it gets to the question of the bully pulpit and the need or requirement, to the extent you think there is one, of the Secretary of State and of the President of the United States to be speaking out on behalf of democracy and human rights. The President of the United States was inaugurated. He never mentioned the word democracy. He never mentioned the word freedom. That's a pretty stark contrast from President Bush's second inaugural. We've come a long way from the words that you so articulately spoke in your Cairo speech that you mentioned, or by the way, in President Obama's Cairo speech.
Right.
Has America changed direction?
These are early days for this administration, and there's a pretty steep learning curve for a president who has never been in government before, never carried those responsibilities of the presidency. You know, it's a learning curve for every president. But if you're a senator, you've been in and around the Oval, and you know what that room means. If you are a governor, you've been in and around the Oval. Certainly, if you're the son of a president, you've been in and around the Oval. You know what it means. I see, though, a president who's beginning to feel the weight of that office. You know, you can't sit at Roosevelt's desk and remember and not remember the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. You can't look at Washington or Lincoln and not feel the weight of history of our country and all of it's been that it's been through for democracy. When the president decided to strike Syria, for instance, after the chemical weapons used by the Assad regime, it was a very interesting moment because he said, I can't let that stand. The Syrian babies choking on chemical weapons. He might as well have said, I'm the president of the United States and I can't let that stand. And so let's see how this evolves. I'm looking forward to the president having a chance to go and see what American support for small states like Estonia and Latvia has meant for decades, but now as a part of NATO, to go to a place like Israel and see what it's like to be a democracy in a sea of countries that would have destroyed you had it not been for your toughness and your will. And so these are early days, and I think the president and many around him have not been in government. Let's give it a little time.
Just to be so I understand where you're coming from, though, on the foreign policy, do you see that the Republican Party has changed its views toward the role of democracy promotion and freedom and human rights in our foreign policy? You know, that has been associated very much with the Bush administration. Is it still your Republican Party?
Well, I listen to a lot of our senators, whether it is, of course, John McCain or Lindsey Graham, but also listen to Dan Sullivan sometimes talk about these issues, or listen to Joni Ernst. These are people who served for these values and who risked their lives for these values, people who served in the military. And so I don't think my party is going to walk away from the principles. And yes, George W. Bush stood for these principles, but they were probably most strongly articulated by Ronald Reagan. Because when Ronald Reagan talked about peace through strength, he wasn't talking about peace as the absence of war. He was talking about an environment in which justice and liberty could thrive. And so, no, I don't think the Republican Party is going to walk away from this. And ultimately, I don't think the President of the United States is going to walk away from it.
That would be a big flip-flop, though. You do acknowledge that would be a marked change.
That's why I don't think it's going to happen. I understand, Susan, why Americans get a bit jaded about, quote, democracy promotion. And one thing I wanted to do with this book was to say to people, democracy promotion is not Iraq and Afghanistan, right? I would never have said to President Bush, let's use American military divisions to go in and deliver democracy to Afghanistan and Iraq. We had security problems in both of those places. Once we had overthrown the dictators, one because they were harboring al-Qaeda, the other because we thought he had reconstituted his weapons of mass destruction, and he had been a threat in the region and was still a threat in the region. Once we overthrew them, we had to have a view of what we ought to try to help bring about after. And so that was a separate decision that, all right, we should try to help the Iraqi or Afghan people get on a road to democracy. But democracy promotion is usually not that dramatic. It usually comes rather out of circumstances like the way that we helped Colombia to take back its country from almost failed state status, through democratic security, as Uribe called it, support for that through Plan Colombia that had started with President Clinton and with President Bush and continued with President Obama, bipartisan, over a long period of time. It means helping Kenya to get through a bad election into a place where they can accept the consequences of the next election. It means trying to help the Ukrainians deal with the most difficult circumstances, a neighbor that is constantly trying to dismember it as it's trying to find its own way to both identity and to liberty. So I wanted this book to say to Americans, don't think about democracy promotion as something that we do with hundreds of thousands of American forces. We usually do it in much more subtle ways. And oh, by the way, we are best served to do it with our allies while they can still reform. Mm-hmm. If Mubarak had continued the reforms that he started in 2005, we might never have had him thrown out of office in 2011.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was reading that section of the book, and it reminded me of, you know, the late, great Soviet-era poet Yevtushenko.
Yes.
And his sort of fatal half measures poem.
Absolutely.
Right? You know, and I think actually many of the anecdotes and the examples in your book could fall under the heading of fatal half measures, you know, where reform is usually, it's not that it's not never tried, right? It's often that it's too late or incomplete.
It's either too late or incomplete, or in the case of Mubarak, people get scared. He got frightened when the Muslim Brotherhood won big in the elections, the legislative elections, even though the presidential election had gone relatively well. But you have to keep pressing people because, you know, the same frustrations and disappointments that led to the Arab Spring aren't going away in the Middle East. You can keep a lid on it for a while, but eventually it's going to explode, and we have a lot of interest in having our allies reform before their people are in the streets.
Well, that's a pretty important point. And you brought up Iraq, and you wrote a very interesting thing in your book, basically making the point that unfortunately, because of this association with Iraq and Afghanistan and the overall trend of violence in the region, that now some people have associated democracy or democracy promotion with violence and instability. Mm-hmm. And that's not just true in the Middle East. You could argue that Vladimir Putin, that was the case he made to the Russian people, was basically democracy equals chaos and instability. Number one, do you think there's anything to that critique that perhaps the invasion of Iraq has discredited the more general idea of democracy in the region?
Well, there's no doubt that the way that Iraq played out, and I talk in the book about some of the mistakes that we made in not understanding what institutions we might have used, there's no doubt that it's caused people to say, well, is it possible then to have democracy in the Middle East? But Iraq and, to a certain extent, Afghanistan were sort of the most stressing cases because you had totalitarian regimes with nothing underneath. My definition of a totalitarian regime comes really from the way that Mussolini talked about totalitario, in which he said that it is the state, all in the state, all for the state, nothing outside the state. So the perfect example is one that we know well. In Joseph Stalin's Soviet Russia, Prokofiev and Shostakovich are persecuted for not writing music that's socialist enough. When you think about that, that's what you mean by totalitarian state. And then you don't have any institutions, and it's extremely hard to do anything. And so that's what happened in Iraq. But the Middle East is more than just that kind of circumstance. You have a wide variety of kinds of regimes in the Middle East.
No, I know that. But the specific question, right, is not really about that, right? Everybody understands that, you know, sort of defeat may be an orphan, but, you know, that in reality it had many fathers there. But the specific question of the American invasion of Iraq and what that has done to discredit democracy promotion, including within our own government, the president, President Trump, has said invading Iraq was a terrible mistake, even though he was probably for it at the time.
Yeah, before he was. Well, look, the fact is we didn't invade Iraq for democracy promotion. And I want people
right.
to understand
no,
that.
No, I know. Yeah. I understand that. But
and the fact that it was hard after. But let me just be very clear. I would rather be Iraqi than Syrian today. I would rather be Iraqi with a prime minister who might be weak, but he's accountable to the people. With 25 different newspapers and radio stations and Arab satellite available. And where my government doesn't actually use barrel bombs and chemical weapons against me. So when I hear about how poorly the Iraqis are doing, I want to say, in regards to what or in comparison to what? So you can posit that it was better for the Iraqis to continue under a dictator who was putting 300,000 people in mass graves, if you want to make that case. I don't want to make that case. And when people say, well, Iraq is such a disaster, I want them to explain to me why they think that under Saddam Hussein it was a bucolic, benign dictatorship.
So you mentioned elections. I think the Middle East has some amazing case studies, obviously, of both the promise of elections, but also the failures and the perils.
Yeah.
And you write in your book of that moment, that shock when you realize that Hamas, who had not been expected to win, was going to win the elections, basically, you know, free and fair, more or less, elections to take over Gaza. That dealt a serious blow to your own peacemaking efforts between the Israelis and the Palestinians. It was not expected. You had pushed hard for the elections. You write about that moment. there are a lot of other moments in the book and not in the book. Right now, I'm thinking of the elections that Vladimir Putin has repeatedly won in Russia. Or to take Europe, you have Viktor Orban in Hungary, who has won elections. This is a member of the European Union. And now he talks about something called illiberal democracy in Turkey. And by the way, President Trump is going to be receiving President Erdogan here next week in Washington. You have a dramatic rollback of democracy. There's no other way to talk about it after just a referendum that expanded the president's powers. But over time, certainly, you can question that referendum. He's won. And yet you seem to have undiminished faith in the power of elections to one day matter. How do you reconcile these things?
Well, my undiminished faith is that elections have to happen. And then the question is, can you improve the context in which they happen? And there are a couple of ways that you can do that. One is, I think one mistake we made with Hamas was we really should have said they had to disarm if they were going to participate in the elections, along the lines of what was done in Northern Ireland, for instance, or where Sinn Féin was able to run for elections, but the IRA couldn't be an armed part of it. So that's one thing. Don't let armed militias participate in elections because they have a, shall we say, unfair advantage. It would be true, for instance, of Hezbollah in Lebanon. But a more important one is that, yes, if you have elections and the only organized forces are Islamists, radical Islamists, then you're going to get a bad outcome. In Egypt, when the Muslim Brotherhood did so well, there was a reason for that, which is that the Muslim Brotherhood could organize in the radical mosques and the radical madrasas, whereas Mubarak had hounded liberal forces like Ayman Nur and others, shut down their newspapers, closed it, put him in jail. So when Mubarak would say to me, "I'm all," he would say, "me, Mubarak, all standing between the Muslim Brotherhood and Egypt," I would think, yes, because you made it that way. Because you didn't allow liberal forces to emerge. Now, if you look at Tunisia instead, you have Islamists, but you also have a nationwide labor movement that was able to help check it and moderate it. You have women's movements that were able to moderate it and check it. So I think we make a false choice when we say, if you have an election, the Islamists are going to win. Well, yes, if you disable all other forces.
So one takeaway as an American policymaker is that not all elections are created equal. Basically, different societies have different election issues.
They have different election issues, but you can work before those elections are held to try to improve the landscape for other forces.
See, here, I feel like you're the classic, the sort of like progressive era, reformer here in a way. You're saying you being America.
No.
What if America doesn't show up to help?
Not America. Helping the people on the ground who want to improve their circumstances. Mm-hmm. We can't do this for them. Yeah. One of the things that I criticize in the book is liberal parties, particularly in Russia, that have no answer for the widow in Perm who's just lost her benefits and want to play power politics inside and around the Kremlin. Mm-hmm. So we can't stand in for these liberal forces, but we can support them and help them to the degree they can. But what Solidarity showed in Poland by being a nationwide labor movement that was ready to move when the democratic opening came, what has happened in Tunisia, where you have multiple kinds of civil society groups able to step forward, what you are beginning to see in other places in Eastern Europe, Poland, let's take Poland for example, where even though there are challenges from the Law and Justice Party to the democracy, you have a lot of other forces that are fighting back.
Do you think that America would have, that if America had not showed up in effect in some way in these countries at the end of the Cold War, as you pointed out, Ronald Reagan made support for dissidents, made support for human rights a pillar of his, not just of his rhetoric, but it was a part of our policy at other times. You know, certainly there's always been the American example or the American ideal, but there's a long conflict in American foreign policy between those who see the promotion of human rights as a pillar of what we stand for in the world and those who project a more realistic point of view, a realpolitik point of view, you started out your career and you were known as more of a realist. But now I feel like this book is your full-throated acknowledgement that no, that's not what I came away from government believing.
Absolutely. And let me just make a little distinction in terms, because it's really important. You know, realism comes out of political science. And basically, it's a theory that the international system is made up of billiard balls that bounce into each other. It's all about power. It doesn't matter what's inside them. I think we have always found, and it's a, frankly, it was kind of European 19th century view. It was all about who could win more power. And it was zero sum. If I gave up power, you took it. Now, America has valued a balance of power that favors freedom, meaning that we've believed that what's inside those billiard balls actually matters. That's why we advocated for a democratic Germany as part of the answer toward a peaceful Europe after World War II. Churchill is supposedly...
Right, over the... our allies didn't want it.
No, I mean, I don't know if it's apocryphal, but Churchill supposedly said, I like Germany so much, I'd like as many of them as possible. Okay, break it up, make it weak. That's balance of power thinking. That's realism. But to bet on a democratic Germany, that was a novel idea, and it's worked. Now, the other thing about... And the reason I wanted to say realism as opposed to realistic is I would say that the more realistic thing is to say is, what happens when you have democracies in the world? They don't employ child soldiers. They don't harbor terrorists as a matter of state policy. They don't invade their neighbors. If you're realistic about authoritarians, they do all of those things. And oh, by the way, they don't have the one important shock absorber that democracies have. People can't change their circumstances peacefully. And so when an autocracy fails, you get an explosion. So I would say that the more realistic policy is to recognize that what happens inside those billiard balls actually really matters.
A lot of people, probably most people in the United States would agree with you. The question on American foreign policy is a little bit more, well, do we have the power and the instrumentalities to really do something about it? And, you know, here you actually see a surprising kind of commonality between Barack Obama, arguably, and Donald Trump, both saying not that we're against democracy or even disagreeing with your argument, right, but that this is not a moment when the United States has the ability to shape those outcomes
way. That just isn't very, it doesn't have very great faith in America and what it's done for almost now more than half a century, because we have shaped outcomes. You know, great powers who have a view of how human history ought to unfold can have a big impact on the world. Mm-hmm. And if we had taken the view that we couldn't shape the international system, then a lot of people might have been speaking either Russian or German. And so the United States has the power with supporting others. You asked a very interesting question. With Ronald Reagan, he spoke about human rights, and he spoke about freedom, and he went and told Gorbachev to tear down the wall. But even well before Ronald Reagan, it had been support through the Council for Security and Cooperation in Europe, going back to the 70s, where these human rights advocates and these civil society groups from inside the Soviet Union and inside Poland and inside Hungary had been able to get out and go to a conference in Geneva or a conference in Bonn and feel the support of others, even though they couldn't act at that moment. And you know what? When the Soviet Union collapsed, they were there, they were stronger, they were ready to lead the democratic transition. Ronald Reagan, and I talk about it in the book, Ronald Reagan, through the CIA, the Vatican through Pope John Paul II, and Lane Kirkland of the AFL-CIO kept solidarity alive when martial law was declared in Poland at the beginning of the 80s. And by keeping solidarity alive underground, when the opening came, solidarity was ready. But that's what we should do.
I guess that's my question, right, is if that were today, would that happen? I'm assuming that you're not in favor of a 30% cut in the State Department's budget?
Well, let's wait and see if it really turns out to be a 30% cut, because, of course, the administration proposes, but Congress actually authorizes and appropriates. I understand. Look, I was provost of Stanford. I had to make big budget cuts. Sometimes efficiencies are a good thing. And I will say this. The State Department seems to have grown since I left. So I don't know whether there is room for cuts or not. I think Rex Tillerson is the right person to take a look at that. But I sure hope that some of the programs that have been really important, you know, America's Compassion through PEPFAR, the AIDS relief program, saving millions of people in what was a pandemic that was threatening to wipe out most of a continent. Mm-hmm. When you look at Millennium Challenge, which was a foreign assistance program that is different in that it demands of the recipient that they be governing wisely, that they're governing democratically, that they're fighting corruption. And so it's a partnership that has worked. So whatever happens in the cuts, I hope that some of these more important and signature programs will not, that they do it with a scalpel, not with a hammer.
So I want to make sure we get back to Russia, but you've mentioned Rex Tillerson a couple times and your support for him. I don't know the backstory. Did you know him before? Obviously, you've worked with him. Yeah. How did you meet him, and why did you decide he was the right person to be secretary?
I actually met him over golf. We were paired in the AT&T National Pro-Am, and when you're trekking around with somebody for 3 days, you learn a lot about them. Bob Gates knew him from the Boy Scouts going back a long way, and then we had done some work with him at Exxon. But
directly with him?
Yes, directly with him. Mm-hmm. But, you know, oil men know the world like other people don't know it. I'd been a Chevron director. I'd seen this. They make long-tail investments in difficult places. They have to deal with difficult people. Their workers work in hostile circumstances. Sound a little bit like being Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. And I thought, really, that President Trump needed a different kind of Secretary of State. He needed maybe a business peer, mm-hmm. and Rex would certainly fill that bill. But I know him as somebody who really knows the world and has, and I know people said, well, he negotiated with the Russians. Well, if you're an oil man, as the oil people say, Russia has great geology. Of course you're going to negotiate with the Russians. But as we've seen, he's going to uphold American interest. I'm not sure I would have been quite brave enough going into the Kremlin to say that the Russians were either incompetent or were not telling the truth about the chemical weapons agreement with the Syrians. So good for him.
Did you advise him on that first trip to Russia?
I did not advise mm-hmm. him on that first trip to Russia, but I watched it with great amusement. It was great.
You know, you talk a little bit in the book about your first trip with President Bush to see President Putin back in 2001, the famous looked into his eyes and saw his soul moment. Yeah. I was just actually, Dan Fried was one of our previous guests on this, and he and I were talking about that on the podcast, and he said he was sitting next to you in the bleachers. Do you remember?
Yes, I do remember that. Yeah.
Yeah, he said you gasped. Was it a gasp?
Well, it wasn't exactly the way I would have put the relationship with Putin. You know, President Bush was trying. He was asked, do you trust him? And it's kind of a hard question when you're standing next to the Russian president for the first time. Do you say, well, no, not really? You don't want to repeat the trust but verify line. That's Reagan. And I think he was looking for a way to deal with it. But what I was really thinking, Susan, was, oh, why didn't I warn him that question was going to come? That's why I gasped.
Right. That's to always prepare your principal,
exactly,
right? That's
exactly.
Jim Baker's mantra, prior right. preparation.
Right.
Now, Dan did make a point of saying, yes, that was not in the talking points.
Right. It was not in the talking points. But, you know, he had a really good relationship with Putin. And I remember after 9/11, Putin was the first foreign leader to call. He tried to help in Afghanistan. We really did a lot of good work with the Russians, and then they started to believe that the color revolutions were aimed at them in what had happened in Ukraine and Georgia. And then after the Russian invasion of Georgia, of course, the relationship really soured. But there were a lot of years in between in which we achieved a lot with the Russians.
So I know, this question is one that you've given a lot of thought to, but it seems very relevant given that you're probably one of the people who's had the most experience in the United States with Vladimir Putin. Was there a moment in time when the United States could have done something differently that would change the outcome? A lot of people these days have pointed to me this question of 2008 and the Russian invasion of Georgia next door. Was that a turning point at which made the later taking over of Crimea and the current hostilities in Ukraine inevitable? Was that the key moment? Do you date it back in time farther. You say maybe 2004.
Now, I think the relationship started to experience difficulty after the Orange Revolution in Ukraine. Putin had an idea that the new U.S.-Russia relationship was going to be built around the fight against terrorism, and he was right about that. But when part of the Bush administration's antidote to terrorism became the freedom agenda, now he wanted to get off that train. And we still did a lot of good work together. But by 2008, yes, Georgia happened. I don't think it was a direct relationship to Crimea. Crimea, as you know, because of its relationship to Russia historically, was in a sort of different category. And what had happened in Georgia was also unfortunate in that the Georgians allowed themselves to be provoked by the Russians, and we'd actually talked about not having that happen. But once the invasion of Georgia had happened, it was pretty clear that this relationship was not going to be a close strategic relationship. I think we did a good job in keeping them out of Tbilisi.
Mm-hmm.
I remember a conversation with Sergei Lavrov in which he told me that the unspoken Russian demand was that Misha Saakashvili had to go, the president of Georgia, and told me it was secret between us. And I said, you don't have that conversation with the American Secretary of State. Expect it to be secret.
That's right. You were on vacation, right, at the Greenbrier,
right,
and he called you?
Yeah.
But do you think we should have imposed tougher sanctions, more akin to the ones we have right now?
Well, we certainly tried to get tougher sanctions, but we also didn't want to expose the split with the Europeans.
So they just weren't willing to
They were
there.
The sanctions that we could get done at the time.
Well, and in fact, that is a consistent theme of a lot of the very interesting writing that you have in this book, both about Russia and Ukraine, that, you know, you were trying and balancing, though, internal Bush administration arguments over NATO expansion, as well as with European partners. You recount this one fascinating shouting match between Radek Sikorski of Poland and the German foreign minister, in effect, over NATO expansion and whether people in the former Soviet Union should get a chance to join. But you, on Ukraine, you know, this is one of the big two items on the agenda right now between Russia and the United States at a moment when Trump is a novice, at a moment when there's an investigation of his campaign's dealings with the Russians. These are very sensitive issues. And you recount this almost heartbreaking moment where, first of all, you tell this great story of Vladimir Putin, you know, basically
with Yanukovych,
introducing you to Yanukovych, who was then later became the president of Ukraine and in effect was Vladimir Putin's man in Kiev.
Yeah.
He produces him at his dacha. What was
it? It was quite a moment. We were standing there. Putin had this new office in his dacha, and he was showing it to me. And we're looking out at his gardens, and all of a sudden the door pops open, and this really tall, graying man walks over, and Putin says to me, "Oh, meet Viktor Yanukovych. He is running for president of Ukraine." And I thought, you know, he might well have said, "This meet Viktor Yanukovych, my man in Kiev." And so, yes, it was the way that he was. And, you know, with Ukraine, I remember another time when he called Ukraine a made-up country.
Okay.
And so...
So you always knew it was on his radar.
I knew it was on his radar screen. And unfortunately, when it comes to Crimea, it's not an unpopular thing in Russia, because many Russians consider Crimea to be Russian, remembering that Crimea became Ukrainian because Nikita Khrushchev in 1954 gave it to Ukraine as a gift for 300 years of Russian-Ukrainian friendship. But of course,
at a time when it
was
matter.
The Soviet Union. Yeah. It didn't matter. So we just have to say to Putin, first of all, we'll never recognize Crimea as a part of Russia. But more importantly, I'm worried about what's going on in eastern Ukraine, where there's really a low-intensity conflict going on every single day. Ukrainian soldiers are dying there every week. The Russian separatists, Russian-backed separatists, are getting their arms and their support and their training from the Russian military. And so Putin seems to be very happy with the frozen conflict that he's created in Ukraine, where Kiev can't control that part of the country. And I, for one, think we ought to look to arming the Ukrainians. I've thought that so for some time.
Right. Barack Obama resisted doing that.
Yeah, but people ought to have the right to defend themselves.
So, okay, that brings us back to Russia and its meddling, not only in Ukraine, but in other parts of Eastern Europe and here in the United States in our elections. You know, President Trump hired at one point a campaign chairman who had Paul Manafort, who had worked very closely with Yanukovych, allied oligarchs, and many of the people who are connected with this conflict that's unfolding in eastern Ukraine. That is now under investigation by the FBI. Why is this serious? Why should Americans care?
First of all, it's very serious whenever there is a charge of a foreign power, particularly a hostile foreign power, and I think you could probably count Russia today as hostile, is engaging in this kind of activity inside the United States. Let me say one thing. You know, this isn't our first cybersecurity problem with an outside power. We have the Chinese rattling around in Office of Personnel Management files as well. So maybe we also ought to be doing something about our cybersecurity. But that aside, it's a very serious matter. But let's investigate it. Let's find the truth. And let's, if there is punishment to be meted out, let's do that. But I'm concerned that it has reached a point where everybody's speculating. Everybody's got an answer to what's going on. And what we need is for a responsible body, and I think that's Senate Intelligence, to take a look. They have access to everything. By all reports, they have bipartisan leadership that looks very sound. So let them investigate it. Let them come forward and tell us what happened, and then we can move from there. But I have to tell you, I come from California. As you know, I live in California now, and the level of pitch in Washington around these issues can't be healthy. It's got to be investigated by people who can actually get the facts, and let's get it done quickly so that the speculation can stop.
Right. But other people would say that the flip side is if you're, you know, sort of taking it too much as a matter of due course, you do agree that this is an exceptional event in American politics.
It is exceptional. It's not unprecedented. The Russians have been messing around, trying to mess around in American politics for a long time.
Dick Cheney called it akin to an act of war.
Well, I think that might be a little strong. It's certainly a hostile act. And our problem is, you know, the cyber part of this is new territory. And I don't think we quite know what we're going to do when we experience a cyber attack that challenges us as a nation. But for now, I would really like to see this investigated thoroughly, and let's get some answers so that the country can move on.
Do you think that our democratic institutions are under threat? You talked about the strength of them and they're built up not to just be a strong executive, but there are a lot of people who worry today that the quickly executed and potentially arbitrary dismissal of the FBI director, the criticisms of judges by the leader of a co-equal branch, the president, represents a threat to democracy, the undermining of freedom of the press.
Our democracy is very strong, and whatever someone says, I don't see a press that has been silenced. I see a press that is more active and more vocal than maybe in many, many years. I see courts that continue to act when they believe that constitutionality is at issue. I see governors who are challenging executive orders. I see congresspeople, senators from both sides of the aisle who are raising questions when they see problems. So that's the health of democracy, is that you have multiple channels, multiple power centers which can do this. And, on criticism of the courts, you know, we've been going down this road for a little while. I didn't much like it when President Obama, with the Chief Justice sitting in the State of the Union, called out a Supreme Court decision. And so maybe we've been eroding some of those lines between the branches of government for some time. And maybe we need to think, everybody, about what the founders really said. They are three co-equal branches of government, and they were very careful to give them their own powers, their own authority, and those need to be respected.
You know, the word eroding, I think, is a really interesting word right now. You know, you talked about the level of concern here, but it probably exists in California, too. Okay. What I observe is that people are struggling to redefine, well, what is normal? What is exceptional about this moment in American politics, and what is normal? You're actually in a really good position to help us understand what's the part that we should be concerned about and what is the part that's normal. You talked about, take us inside the White House a little bit. You met not long ago with President Trump. You conjured this image of him at the Roosevelt desk. What is normal about this administration, do you think, and what is not normal? There's a lot of infighting. Just the other day, somebody said to me, well, Condi Rice was fighting, with Dick Cheney, so therefore the Trump administration's infighting is fine. It's not. Is it the same thing?
I can't tell because I'm not inside every day. It is not abnormal to have people positioning within the White House. That is most certainly not abnormal. But I can't tell you the level or whether it's unusual. I can tell you that it is a steep learning curve for any president. It's steeper for this president because he really hasn't been around the government. You know, I actually felt bad for him when he said that it jobs harder than he thought. Sometimes I think when you're on the outside, and I've heard a lot of business people say this, people that I respect, and they just don't see why it's so hard getting things done in Washington.
You know, did President Bush ever say that?
No, because President Bush had been around his father. He knew how hard it was. But I can't tell you how many business people say, well, I don't see why it's so hard to get that done. Why can't they change entitlements? Why can't they do this? Why can't they do that? Sometimes the press, there's a little bit of, with columnists or reporters, you know, well, they just can't get anything done. And I, having been in those positions, I want to say to people, try it for a few days, right? And you'll see why it's hard. It's hard because you do have equal competing power centers that have to be accommodated. Madison was very interesting on this. He said that you're going to have, there should be no permanent losers in democracy. And by that, I think he meant that I don't want to defeat you when I win on a particular policy issue, because the next time around, I might need you. And if I could say anything that's really troubling to me about Washington as I watch it safely 3,000 miles away in California, it's that attitude. I need to defeat you. I don't just need to win this round. I need to defeat you. I heard something the other day that really troubled me. It said, well, the Obamacare helped to defeat the Democrats in the election, and the new health care bill is going to defeat the Republicans in the election. And I thought, is that all this is about? I thought this was about trying to do what's right for the American people. And so I think that's what is disturbing people. And I think, Susan, as much as I myself like social media and use social media, and as much as I like the proliferation of possible sources of news these days, it's a little bit too much that I can go to my corner, my aggregators, my bloggers, my cable news channel, never encounter anybody who thinks differently. And now when I encounter people who think differently, I think they're venal or stupid. We've got to learn to talk across our differences. I tell my students at Stanford, if you are constantly in the company of people who say amen to everything you say, find other company.
Well, nobody's going to accuse Donald Trump of saying amen. You've been super diplomatic, as you always are in this interview, and you've been very convincing that you have managed to not be cynical and to retain your faith in democracy. But I'm going to give you one last chance here, Secretary Rice. You are a true believer in democracy at a time when a lot of people are really scared about it. You know, you were in the White House and at the Department of State, and you were saying, no, we can't torture people. That's wrong, and that violates our values. You have a president of the United States in your own party who campaigned and said, maybe that's a good idea. Doesn't this upset you? Aren't you scared by what's happening?
I know a lot of things are said in campaigns. I'll watch what the president says as president. I think the president's words matter. And
so you don't believe that we should not pay attention to his words?
I think words matter. But I also think these are early days. And I see that we are seeing words that look to me like they are, and I'm speaking now in the area that I know, foreign policy, more strategically placed than, for instance, in the campaign or even in the early days of the administration. I think, for instance, to say to the Chinese, if you don't deal with the North Koreans, we will. There's nothing wrong with that message. I think to say to the Syrians, we are not going to sit by and let you gas Syrian babies. I think there's nothing wrong with that message. I think to say to Vladimir Putin, yes, I want to meet with you, but at an appropriate time. I see nothing wrong with that message. And I think it is reflective also of the strength of the national security team that they have. Rex Tillerson and Jim Mattis and H.R. McMaster and John Kelly. But yes, words do matter. And I follow every day what we're saying. I hope that we will say even more, that the world is really a dark place when the United States of America is not involved. It's a dark place when we don't stand up for those who just want to have the same basic values that we have. The right to say what you think and worship as you please and be free from the knock of the secret police at night and have the dignity that comes with electing those who are going to govern you. Because it's really served us best when America leads from power and principle, and I'm hoping to hear even more of that.
Secretary Condoleezza Rice, I do so appreciate you joining us on the Global Politico today. And, of course, both of us appreciate all of you listening to this conversation. And you can listen to the Global Politico on iTunes or whatever your favorite podcast platform is. I think we've had 1 million-plus downloads so far since we launched this in February. And we hope that you'll keep listening to us. You can subscribe. You can rate us if you'd like. You can sign up for our new newsletter so you get the notice every week when a new episode is up. And I'm Susan Glasser, and you can email me anytime at sglasser.